In the country, I accept the normal and traditional routine, doing what every man does, rising early, eating when I should, turning up my coat collar when it rains. I see the reason for it, and shave at the same hour every morning. Not so in town. When I live in town, I feel no impulse in the starling migrations of the rush hours. There is no tide in any submarine cave anywhere that is not more to me than the inflow and outflow at the cold mouths of offices or the hot mouths of restaurants. I find no growth in time, no need for rain, no sense in sobriety, no joy in drinking, no point in pain, no plan in living. I exist in this alien labyrinth like an insect among men, or a man in a city of ants. I despise the inconsiderable superiority of the glum day over the starless night. My curtains are always drawn. I sleep when my eyes close, eat when I remember to, and read and smoke without ceasing, allowing my soul to leave my wastrel and untended carcass, and seldom do I question it when it returns. My chambers are in the stoniest of the inns of court. I keep no servant here, for I mean always to go back to the country within the week, though sometimes I stay for months, or I don't know how long. I supply myself with immense stocks of cigarettes and such food as I happen to remember, so that I shall have no reason to return from the landscapes of Saturn or the undescribed gardens of Turgenev in order to go out into the streets. My fingers are horribly blistered by the cigarettes that burn down between them while I still walk in the company of women with the heads of cats. Nothing seems strange to me when I wake from such reveries, unless I part the curtains and look out into the square. Sometimes I have to press my hands under my heart to resume the breathing that I have entirely forgotten. I was constantly ambushed and defeated, and I forget what journeys or what loves or where by the fullness of a saucer in which a hand of mine failed to find room to crush out its cigarettes. Habit, which arranges these things, demanded some other receptacle. I rose, holding my thoughts as one holds a brimming glass, and was moved into the bathroom, drawn by the vague memory of a soap dish, which lay stranded like an empty shell on the empty beaches of a blank mind. But swallowed by God knows what high-reaching wave, that shell was gone, and my reviving eyes, straying at first aimlessly, soon called me all back again, poor Crusoe, to regard on the cork mat the new wet, glistening imprint of a naked foot. It was not long before I assured myself that I was dry. Dressed in my pajamas and slippers, and that I was not clean. Moreover, This foot, the prints of whose toes were as round as grated pearls, was neither long like that of a man, nor hideous like that of a bear. It was not my own. It was that of a woman, a nymph, a new-risen Venus. I conceived that my wandering spirit had brought me back a companion from some diviner sea's edge and some more fortunate shell. I drank up this moist footprint with my hot eyes. It dried as I looked upon it. It was not the air took it, but I had it for my own. I examined it for days and nights, building upon its graceful rotundities, arched in steps, ankles equally graceful, and calves proportionately round. I deduced knees, haunches, breasts, shoulders, arms, plump hands and pointed fingers, full neck, small head, and the long curl, like the curve when the wave breaks of the green gold hair. Where there falls one footprint, there must fall the next. I had no doubt I should soon be vouchsafed the dull gleam of her hair. For this I at once became ravenous and slunk restlessly from room to room. I noticed with half-unconscious approval that even the neglected furnishings seemed responsive to the goddess, and stood clean and tidy as onlookers at a holiday. The carpet, as if she were Persephone instead of Venus, bloomed with new flowers beneath her invisible feet. The sun shone through the open window, and warm airs entered. At what moment had I swept back the curtains and extended this invitation to sun and air? Perhaps she had done so herself. It was, however, impossible to attend to such lovely trifles. I desired the gleam of her hair. Forgive me for having rejoiced in the pallor of the dead. Forgive me for having conversed with women who smelled like lions. Show me your hair. I was devoured by a cruel nostalgia for this being who was always with me. Supposing, I thought, waking in my strangely fresh bed, supposing she appeared terrifyingly in the darkness, white as marble and as cold. At that moment I felt an intermittent warmth on my cheek and knew that she breathed beside me. There was nothing to clasp but the empty air. For days I moved to and fro, my blood howling in me like a dog that bays at the moon. There is nothing but the empty air. I persuaded myself that this was nonsense. I had seen the trace of beauty and felt the warmth of life. Gradually, one sense after another would be refracted on this divine invisibility, till She stood outlined like a creature of crystal, and then as one of flesh and blood, as soon as I was well persuaded. I saw her breath dimming upon a mirror. I saw some flowers which had appeared part their petals as she bent her face to them. Hurrying there, I smelled not the flowers, but her hair. I threw myself down and lay like a dog across the threshold, where, once or twice in the day, I might feel the light breeze of her passing. I was aware of the movement of her body, or an eddy in the light where she moved. I was aware of the beating of her heart. Sometimes, as if out of the corner of my eye, I saw, or thought I saw, not her bright flesh, but the light of her flesh, which vanished as I widened my eyes upon it. I knew where she moved, and how she moved, but I was destroyed by a doubt, for she did not move towards me. Could there be some other existence to which she was more responsive, some existence less tangible than her own? Or was she my unwilling prisoner here? Were those movements of which I was not the object the movements of one who longed only to escape? It was impossible to tell. I thought I might know everything if only I could hear her voice. Perhaps she could hear mine. I said to her day and night, "Speak to me. Let me hear you. Tell me you have forgiven me. Tell me you are here forever. Tell me you are mine." Day and night I listened for her answer. I waited in that unutterable silence, as one who in a darkness equally profound might await the arrival of a gleam of light from a star in whose existence he had good reason to believe. In the end, when I had ceased to hope or believe, I became aware of a sound, or something as near to a sound as the light on her cheek was near to the flesh of her cheek, now living only in my eardrum, not moving, not breathing. I waited. This ghost of a sound increased. It passed through infinite gradations of rarity. It was like the sound in the second before the rain. It was like the fluttering of wings, the confused words of water. It was like words blown away in the wind, like words in a foreign tongue. It grew more distinct, closer. Sometimes my hearing failed me, exactly as one's sight fails, dimmed suddenly by tears, when one is about to see the face one has always loved after an ineffable absence. Or she would fall silent, and then I was like one who follows the sound of a brook and loses it under the muffling trees or under the ground. But I found it again, and each time it was clearer and stronger. I was able to distinguish words. I heard the word love. I heard the word happy. I heard in a full opening of the sense, the delicate intake of her breath, the very sound of the parting of her lips. She was about to speak again. Each syllable was as clear as a bell. She said, "Oh, it's perfect. It's so quiet for Harry's work. Guess how we were lucky enough to get it. The previous tenant was found dead in his chair. And they actually say it's haunted."